Episode 0 of Season 17. I'm Lyle Troxell, and this is Geek Speak. With me in the back of a very cold building late at night in our second recording of the evening because, well, the first wasn't really recording, I have Mr. Miles Elam, who's extremely angry with me right now. Hey, Miles, how you doing?
How's it going?
Oh, it's good. We also have Mr. Brian Cordan Young. Brian, your Twitter account is Brian C. Young.
Yes. That's good. I was going to say, what really messed me up last week, what I couldn't remember, is I didn't know whether I had to drop a letter in order to fit it into a certain namespace
last
week.
So it might have been Young.
Yes, I might have been missing some letters. But no, it's all there, just with C in the middle.
And something you might not know about Brian Young is he is actually in Lord of the Rings as one of the elves. But that's not his profession. He's just lucky enough to have done that. So,
Movie making was my profession once.
Yes. Well, movie making, yes, but not acting, not performance.
Oh, that was not performance.
You held a bow. That was performing, sir.
Yes, I shot my bow and arrow. Yes, I did.
And actually, you're historically, you're a 3D animator and lighting person. In fact, you've got such credits as...
You might know me from the shows like Toy Story 2 and Monsters Incorporated.
Except they wouldn't know you because...
Well, I am in the credits, so there you go. Okay. If you sit and watch the 200 or, I know, it's more than that, names roll by.
Yeah. But now, of course, you're a programmer, and let's move on. We're starting the show with a little bit of, you've got something to say.
Well, I was going to thank you, but now that we're having to do it all over again, I'm just going to thank the universe for giving me a hand-me-down Drobo. A couple weeks ago, actually, no, it's a couple months ago now, you pointed to a bag that was sitting in the corner that you said, did you want that? I don't need that anymore. And I said, yes, because I had a whole array of, well, it wasn't an array. I had a whole bunch of drives hanging off my main server computer.
Now it's an array.
Now it's an array. So I was managing on 4 different drives where I was duplicating stuff myself.
Ooh, oh.
And honestly, I wasn't doing a good job because I couldn't tell whether everything was duplicated and where it was and whether my scripts were running all the time to do the duplication. So,
and this is an older Drobo that I handed you that is a USB or FireWire connection. And I got it originally for dealing with my photo collection. So I have a safe place to do photo collection, make sure I wouldn't lose things. And it's a pretty cool device.
No, it's really cool. It's a little on the slow side because how old is it now?
7 or 8, 10 years.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. So I put all my drives in it. It took a while to copy everything over, get everything set up. And just about a week, 2 weeks after I get everything running well, sure enough, one of the drives just fails on me. So I said, yes, I have all my data. And ordered a new drive, swapped them out, took 2 days to rebuild. Whoa. And I am so thankful for hand-me-downs. That was awesome.
Cool. Of course, the stress of getting it onto the system where it's spanning over many drives may have led to the demise of the drive in the first place.
Oh, that's a good point, right? All the work necessary to set up the shared redundant drive thing. I can't recall how the Drobo does it. I think it might be slightly proprietary. One of the things that it does that I don't like in that version is you can set it up to be like it's a 10 gigabyte or 10 terabyte drive, and then your system thinks it's 10 terabytes, but really there's not that much space. And at one point when you start filling it up enough, there's lights on the front that says you better put a bigger drive in, because theoretically if you max them all out, that's the size it would be.
Right. The OS reports it, you've got 5 more gigabytes to go, or terabytes actually. To go.
Yeah. I didn't like that feature. I actually hand that down to you. The reason for that is that I was at a bachelor party, and I ran into a guy that worked at Drobo, and he said, here, let me send you a unit for you to try out. And he sent me the Drobo 5N, which is a network-attached device. Yours is a FireWire USB. And I use that now. I think it's fantastic drive, enclosure, whatever, network-attached storage. We used to use, what was the products we used to have, Miles?
The InFront ReadyNAS.
Yes, the ReadyNAS. I still have...
Bought by Netgear.
Netgear. Yeah. And I still have a couple of those, but I'm actually migrating the data off of them. The thing that's cool about the Drobo 5N, because Drobo's like done a lot of work on the software side, is they have all these services that you can enable. So you can turn on a torrent client on it and actually have it, and you can upload a whole bunch of torrent files, and it will go grab them and then actually be a torrent server, which is kind of cool. And then it also has iTunes and Plex, all these different cool services for
BitTorrent client. That thing was awesome.
Yeah. What?
It had a BitTorrent client on it.
Yeah. So I was talking about the Drobo. The ReadyNAS has these too, but they're kind of old school in the sense they're kind of falling apart as the physical drives are old. But the physical enclosures are old. The Drobo has all these services too, including a Minecraft server if you want to install Java on the ARM processor the thing is running on.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a good point. So would you want to do it through your Drobo, or would you want to just get a Raspberry Pi and set up all your services on that?
Well, Miles likes Raspberry Pis.
I do indeed.
I want to just have it out of the box work.
Right.
That's
you
why
just,
I haven't.
You just want it easy.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Well, the Raspberry Pi isn't a good choice for a NAS.
Why?
But it could be a good choice to run Minecraft or all these
yes,
other things.
It would be fine for a Minecraft server.
How much RAM does it have?
1 gig.
Nah. You want like...
People do it.
Yeah.
But the issue really there is the fact that it doesn't make a good NAS. The I.O. bandwidth just isn't there. It's still using USB 2.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is on USB 2, meaning if you have Wi-Fi on there or Ethernet...
It all slows down.
That's part of that. And then you put a drive on there. That's US. That's part of that 480 megabit per second.
Miles, about channel. Half an hour ago when we had this conversation the first time, you had mentioned about how you're disappointed with network delivery.
I was indeed. The first time that gigabit Ethernet adapters showed up integrated onto motherboards, that was, what, 15 years ago?
It was magical. It was a magical time.
12 years ago, something like that.
Gigabit?
In terms of computing, the computing world, it was a long time
ago.
Yeah,
it was about 12 years ago when it was common.
So where's the update? Where's the 10 gigabit adapters? They're out there, but they cost like $150 a piece. And that's not counting the switches. The switches end up being a lot more than that. And you can run, Cat6 cable. It's okay. Like, you have to pay for that. You can't do it over old Cat5, that type of thing. Or at least not consistently. If you're doing short distances, people have. But
So the problem isn't that the copper just can't handle it. The problem is the price of the adapters.
Well, the adapters have switching. I mean, 10 gigabit per second means you're doing a lot of I/O switching. And apparently that hasn't come down the pipe.
I think the reason it hasn't hit the price point of all the rest of the end user stuff is that people are okay with 1 gigabit. Like, there's not a big problem here.
I'm just not buying that, considering the fact that I have two SSDs in my laptop. Each one can outstrip a gigabit connection. A gigabit can handle 125 megabytes per second, and each of my drives do 500.
Yeah, but in a household, 99% of the people in a household never do networking between their computers. What they're doing networking with is on the internet, which isn't running over a gigabit.
Yeah, you know what? People still need... I still want to have a storage unit. I still want to have the option that isn't an arm and a leg to do. Like, it used to be, I'm going to set up a dedicated machine because, a NAS that was commercial that had gigabit was way too expensive
right.
at the time. But you could build up a separate computer for a reasonable amount of money that could spit out a gigabit per second.
Outside your home, forget about it. You're going to be fine with gigabit because you're not going to get a network connection to your house that's faster than that. And inside your house, when are you actually doing a lot of transfer between machines? You're not generating that much content, right? So, and you can't consume that much content unless you're a video editor, right? Like, if you're editing video, that's when you need it.
On the contrary, when I want to... Okay, I am unusual. I would like to be able to take stuff like OpenStreetMap data and be able to serve that very quickly, just like copy it as though the network drive is my local drive.
From your Raspberry Pi and stuff?
Yeah.
I was just talking about...
But make it so that my laptop is the stuff that I need, and the drives just aren't that big, and it doesn't have the redundancy, and just set up a server that has...
The problem you're talking about is the reason why I first bought the Drobo that Brian now has, because it has FireWire connection, and it's a Stripe direct. And, of course, mm-hmm. this is when we had spinning platters was the fastest data you could get. Now, of course, the speed of that thing is not even close to the SSD.
And it was given to you?
No, I bought that.
You bought it?
I bought the one that Brian has. The one that I currently have was given to me.
Okay.
All right. So let's move on. Brian, last week we talked really.
We missed that last part.
Go ahead.
That we did before. That we, which was
edit point.
Which was that wireless is now exceeding gigabit speeds.
What do you mean
You can buy APs that go faster than a gigabit per second, especially if you are within 10 feet.
Well, it's nice because you also don't have to swap out the cables.
But it is ridiculous that a wired cable is going to do worse than wireless.
Miles, I don't even have an Ethernet jack on this computer. Ethernet's dead, man. Wi-Fi all the way. Like, who cares that it's... I mean, yeah, you know, you can't get faster than 10 megabits per second over coax either. But who cares? Right? I mean, technology dies. Ethernet's just going away. You don't like that answer?
No, I don't really like that answer.
Why?
At all. You have 802.11 AC on your laptop.
Yes.
But on how many channels?
I don't know.
Like how many antennas? How many
Probably
independent
two,
channels?
Maybe one.
One of the things about many of these routers, they support multiple channels. So if you were able to multiplex, and you can with them talking to each other, you can have some really nice bandwidth between two endpoints.
Right, gotcha. But not each device.
But one of the issues is that you are doing that over the air, which means that someone can listen and someone can try to break into your network.
Right.
If you have an Ethernet cable, for example, if I'm going to my shed and I bury it under the ground, that's it. That there's no signal going.
Okay, but
out.
Don't you want to skip up and, like, why is 10 gigabit your end all be all? Why don't you just do
It's
fiber?
Not my end all be all. I've just been waiting 15 years for it. Right now, there are internet connections going around the country that are gigabit per second or faster. Mm-hmm. They are now getting to the point that they are faster than the Ethernet connectors on our computers.
Which is crazy.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
That's not crazy. That's delicious. Now, if you had your 10 gigabit NICs, can they go over the Cat5e cable that you've laid already, or do you have to lay Cat6
cable?
Can't
lay Cat6. Although if your Cat5e is a short enough run, if it's in your house and it's a relatively short run and you did it correctly, then theoretically it can do that. Wait, no, it can't do 10 gig. I'm sorry.
I think the problem is that you're a dinosaur and not so few people are willing to lay that cable anymore that they just want to go get that gigabit connection on their AC Wi-Fi router.
Yeah, you know what? For home, I understand that argument. For a business,
yeah.
I don't.
Well,
I think
course,
that totally
falls
down.
For a business, they go to 10 gig. They just pay for the extra price.
But how do you pay that extra price on a laptop? There are really no 10 gigabit per second dongles going to your Thunderbolt connector.
You know, when I got my new machine from my old and transferred data between the old machine, I used Thunderbolt to USB-C connector, and I transferred like 40 gigabytes, and I didn't even really notice it. Like, I mean, it took of course it takes some time, but I went and got a cup of coffee at work and came back, and it was transferred. Didn't go outside the two machines connect to each other. So maybe that's the solution. You just have local hard drives that have your fast data on it.
And a reason why I want faster in my home, backups. Yeah. I want my backups to go faster.
Yeah. All right. I get that. Speaking of the home, last week, Brian, you mentioned that you got the Google Home, and we were talking about skills and ability to upgrade, and we chatted a lot about that last week. Did you learn anything more about that?
So I had the chance to finally look to see what I could do, see if there's anything it can do, like the Amazon Alexa and the skills you can add to that. And no, it doesn't have any of the plug-in skills that you can do like Alexa. They both, however, do have integration with If This Then That. How do you say the initialism?
If This Then That is really, it describes what it does. It's a web service that does one thing if something else happens.
Yeah, right. IFTTT. Yeah.
Yeah, IFTTT.
So what it is internet glue to connect one service to something else and allow you to automate it.
I used to, every time I published an episode of GeekSpeak, I had an If This Then That rule that looked for the podcast, the RSS feed, saw that a new entry existed, and made a tweet about it, right? So simple things like that.
Right. So it saved you that 10 seconds it took to send the tweet. Google Home does have integration with that, and it has something better than what Alexa can do in that you can set up customized commands using the
voice
If This Then That. So you can actually give it a command, and it understands both the command, we'll call it the verb, and everything you say after that as being the subject of what you're talking about. So
give me an example.
You're going to get me on that one. I haven't done one of the integrations yet. So A good example might be, oh, well, a tweet. So you could set up the command would be something like tweet to my GeekSpeak account. And then whatever you say after that will be the text that's sent to your GeekSpeak account.
Cool, cool.
Yeah.
So it has good integration with If This Then That.
Yeah, more robust than what Alexa can do.
Oh, nice.
Which is its only expansion option.
All right. I'm assuming they'll also extend it at some level.
Everybody expects that they're going to come out with an API for developers to start extending it.
Fun Google Home anecdote. Had a friend of mine, her 5-year-old son, she has two children. The 5-year-old is the older one. Apparently went up to the Google Home device and whispered to it to change the channel of his little brother's program on TV. This is the new generation. This is the pranking of the new generation.
And so the kid didn't know why the channel changed, just changed.
Right. His older brother was just like,
and of course, one of Google Home's biggest advantages is that it can integrate with Chromecast and show photos and videos and everything.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Have you seen anything about Google Home being a better artificial intelligence, if you will, than Siri, for example? I know you have more experience with Siri than Alexa.
I do. I mean, I've read a lot about it, but I can't say that I've seen it firsthand that it's better. What it is better is everything that Google Search is better at. So if you're trying to find information that you have some vague notion of what it is and you can speak that, it's better at finding that than most things that Siri or I believe Alexa can search for. Things that are on Wolfram Alpha. Mm-hmm. Alpha is where Siri excels pretty well, but I'm pretty sure Google can integrate with data that would come from there as well.
You know, it's funny, now that I've got the Echo thing in my house, and of course I've got Siri devices, you have to like learn two different lingos to deal with them, right? And so you kind of know what Siri can do and what it can't do, and what Google and the Home thing can do and can't do. And it's a little frustrating that it's not like they're learning for us. We're learning for
right,
them.
Right, yeah. Exactly. You're using your brain cells to figure out who you're talking to and make it do what you want.
The only thing they both do really well is timers. That's the win. I was cooking tonight and I need a 3-minute timer and it worked perfectly.
But the Google Home can't do reminders. If you say,
oh, it can't?
No. If you say, remind me to take out the trash at 9 o'clock, it'll say, I'm sorry.
No,
I can't do that.
Echo can't do that either.
Yeah. But that's what I'm so used to on my Siri, on my phone.
Moving on, speaking of AIs, tell us about Go and AlphaGo specifically.
Yes. AlphaGo is Google's, they're also known as DeepMind, but it's a Google project. And it has beaten Go players in the past. Last March, it was in the news for having beaten some of the top Go players, one of the top Go players, 4 out of 5 games. And that Go player was actually a bit confused how he was being congratulated for winning 1 game out of 5 and how unusual that was. But it was against an AI. Because chess had fallen, Kasparov had been beaten, on a couple of occasions. Go was this new last bastion. This is where human beings were.
It's a much more complicated game than chess, right?
Right. We talked about this in the past where it is so many different possibilities, you can't store them in all the memory of all the computers on the planet.
There's or all the many atoms on the universe. I think it's one of those scales that just it's exponentially large in a crazy way. And then Go, of course, is that game where it's a whole bunch of intersecting lines and you can place a white or a black token on those lines. And the two players are trying to take as much territory as possible. And if you trap your opponent's colors between yours, you swap those colors out to your color. And
or you remove them from the board. You have that territory.
Where you have the territory now. And that game, just the complexity is so grand that you can't really model it the same way you can chess by looking forward to all possible moves.
Right. So using a neural network, DeepMind AI has been, or AlphaGo has been, doing much better. So after that one loss, the programmers went back and started tweaking and started working on it and finding where its deficiencies might lay.
Is that equivalent to the system just hanging its head and going back in shame and trying to figure out how to do better?
They started having it play games online. and players didn't necessarily know they were playing against an AI. When they started looking at
online Go championships or something, right. Or like playing areas. Oh, cool.
Right. And so after they saw some of the winning records and they saw some very, very unorthodox moves that just didn't, human beings just don't do.
You know, people started recognizing this player.
They started recognizing that it was an AI, but they weren't sure if it was AlphaGo or some other.
How is it doing online?
So it played 51 games. One of the games was a draw where it lost connection. And so the system just called it a draw because
The players
didn't come
just
to
got disconnected.
They got rained
didn't
out.
Come to conclusion, yeah. The other 50 games, 50 straight games, it won.
Which means the human lost.
The human lost.
And these are, I'm assuming, are good players?
These are world-class players, yes.
Oh, no.
Now, wait a second. The humans didn't lose. The humans gained an AI.
That's true. We still control it. The other humans over at Google's headquarters won. Interesting. Okay, so Go now is a no longer a domain of humans. It's a domain of computers.
Right.
So I wonder if Go will have the same side effect of Miles last week's episode, which I published 5 minutes ago, so you haven't heard it yet. we talked a lot about Kasparov. Has actually coming out with a book relatively soon, but he was talking about how now the best chess players on the planet are a really good champion-level chess player with a laptop, and that can beat anything else. So the AIs can beat humans, no problem, but a human with assist can beat an AI, which is kind of cool. I wonder if that's going to be the same for the Go championships.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to find out. Yeah. So is this the same kind of AI that's been really successful lately with things like Google Photos and so many other services out there? It's a neural network or?
It is a neural network. I don't know the intricacies of it. I don't think many people do outside of the team working on it.
That was one of the things that was so interesting about the championship last time that was got studied with those five games is that it made plays where other people are like, oh, that's creative. That's different. Like the experts were seeing kind of like a creative quality to it and used poetic words to describe how it was playing. So yeah, not understood by the programmers. Totally a neural net pattern.
So it's learning. I wonder, is it learning between games or is it learning during the game? Do you understand how the neural nets work that way?
They get trained.
Yeah, I think they have extensive training sets. Yeah. And the equivalent of a human being playing Go, you know, every day, all day, for their entire life,
yeah.
Times
and of course,
an
every
inordinate
time,
number of numbers.
Every time it wins or loses, that goes into its training data. Because afterwards, it can be used as a feedback system. Because, of course, the training data can be quite large because the goal point is so simple. Like, that's the thing about the system. Even though chess and Go is much more complicated than chess, both of them have a very simple win state. And therefore, it's easy to understand. It's not like successfully driving a car. It's just a totally different level. Success rate means over long periods of time never failing. There's no win state, you know? Just continually going.
The win state is everybody's still alive.
I was about to say, like, a win state, if you do it per trip.
Okay, better example would be writing good poetry. How does it confirm that it succeeded? Well, humans have to tell it. Like, that's it.
Unless you have other AIs go like, yeah, that was pretty good.
I like that. Just remove the humans from the whole story. All right, Brian, let's talk about televisions.
Yeah. So I like old stuff, apparently. We're talking about old machines. Yeah, I collect old machines. So the last TV I bought was a plasma TV. I think it's going on 10 years.
Does it have burn-in image problems?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. When my kids play, what are they playing these days?
Something with a
Skyrim. Hide. When they play Skyrim, and it totally gets burned in. I hate that. But it's okay. I haven't had anything that's gone more than a couple days. So
I love that. What are the kids playing these days?
Get off my HUD.
What I like is to be able to build my own system. I get something, a couple simple things, and put them together. So I've got my simple dumb TV, and I've got my AV setup, which takes in the four different inputs and sends it out to the TV. But nowadays, if you want to go buy a TV, you've got to get a smart TV. It's really all that's on the market. And many of these are running Android, or I don't know if there's any other operating system that tends to be running on a smart TV.
Yeah, there's WebOS.
Oh, of course, WebOS. Mm-hmm. The OS that's everywhere, but
there's Roku.
Phones.
It's its own operating system, I think. I don't think it's an Android derivative.
Well, Darren Cawthon, I think I pronounced that right, is a software engineer who also had an LG 50GA6400.
That's what I got.
He woke up on Christmas Day and was sad to see that his entire TV was unfunctional because it was taken over by ransomware.
No. So so just on the TV screen said, yeah, if you don't pay this amount, the TV won't work?
And just to add insult to injury, the horizontal TV had a vertical image on it. So you had to turn your head to read it.
That's great. So was it just a scene of like a whole bunch of people taking their televisions and throwing them out their windows? Much were they charging?
So the ransomware was requesting $500.
That's like half the cost of a television.
Oh yeah. Well, the ransomware has to get the price point that's just right, where it's enough that they make a good, decent amount of money, but it doesn't go past the pain point that somebody's just going to...
The thing with that, though, is it's just about money. In this situation, if they pay it, it could be that they have to pay it again. So there's no, it's not like they're losing anything except for money, right? Because the person that's...
Why would they have to pay it again?
Because the ransom people can be like, oh, good job. And then a month later, just do it again.
Oh, yeah.
There's no guarantee that you won't get hit again.
Absolutely. Well, unless you do something to your network. I don't know.
I mean, that's the thing about... Yes, you're right. You could protect your network to some degree, but how are you going to protect the TV operating system? In fact, even when you pay the ransom, the TV comes back on, you're not even sure if that ransomware is still not sitting there watching what you're doing.
And you're not sure if the OS has been updated to protect against it.
Yeah, because these things are locked down. So what do you do?
Well, he's a programmer. He reset the thing.
Cool.
Well, so cool. You reset it and clear it out and start it back up again. But no, the ransomware was smart enough to be able to handle the case where a normal user can reset the TV.
Sure.
So he wasn't able to clear it.
In the menu system somewhere, you reset, which means it deletes all the apps you've got on there if it's got apps, and it basically gets you back to factory reset.
Let me guess. It probably just deletes all user data.
It probably does.
And it leaves the OS intact. That's my guess. Anyways, he started complaining to LG, and they said, well, you can take it to this technician. And he looked up the price of the technician, and for $340, the technician would also reset the machine in possibly a better way.
So the technician, or LG, is also ransomwaring his television.
And of course, he kept complaining on Twitter, where LG eventually relented and free gave him enough knowledge that he could do the reset himself.
The secret codes. Did he share the secret codes with people?
I don't believe so.
Oh, interesting.
So I don't know if there's a backroom deal on that.
And so what that did is reset it even at a harder level. Got it back to the ROM stage or something.
If I had to guess, it probably reinstalled the whole OS, which is what it should have done in the normal reset. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a reason. If you had the user navigational reset do a hard reset to factory reset levels, what's actually happening in that machine, most likely, there is a ROM level OS, functional OS of some sort, that does something. And what it probably does is call home and say, is there new updates? And the new updates come down the line. And all those are all packages and take time and have to download. So it kind of makes sense that they're going to say, well, once we know we get a steady state, at that point, we don't want to have the user reset again to that, right? We want to have the user reset to, not at the very beginning, but kind of a halfway point. But also, what happens if they, how would they fix the ransomware hole, if you will? You know what I'm saying? Like, if the television had the vulnerability in the first place and you reset it, you're racing time. Is the ransomware going to get back on the device, or are you going to get back on the device? So I kind of get the protection level.
Or are you just going to stop watching TV?
Well, that was the other thing is, like, I don't know, Christmas morning, the TV says no. That's a good reason to do something else.
Well, actually, if you're using it as a dumb TV, you shouldn't connect it to the network at all. Just live with whatever OS it came with.
Yeah, assuming it can do anything. Like, maybe it has to. I don't know.
That's why I love my mom's TV.
Is it dumb TV?
It's a dumb TV that has that came with a Roku stick.
Nice.
Like, they marketed it as a smart TV, but really it's like, oh, okay, they're just bundling the Roku stick. So,
do you know what Roku stick it is? Which version?
It actually is an older one. Okay. I had thought about paying the entire $30 to get the new updated one.
If you're going to get a new one, I recommend the Roku 3.
She has a Roku 3 in the bedroom.
Okay.
On that TV, and it is nice. It has the remote control with the headphone jack. But it turns out that if you get the newer version of the stick than what we have, what she has in the living room, that you can use your smartphone as to plug in headphones.
Yeah, yeah.
Assuming you don't have an iPhone 7.
Ouch.
It hurts me every day. I have to tell you, I was traveling recently, and man, I hate not having a headphone. It's one of those things where I'll charge my phone. I want to listen to something. Oh, I can't do both those things at the same time.
Wait, you can't? I thought there were like Y dongles.
Well, yeah, but he doesn't have it.
I didn't buy the Y dongle. I got enough dongles. Like, there's dongles everywhere. The Roku 3 around the office, people, like, we're working on the TVs. The Roku 3 can do like alpha blending images, transfer over. It's got a lot of RAM space for the image buffer and all that. So the Roku 3 is one of those ones that it can always do everything we need it to do. And so can the game systems. So,
As a side thing with regard to ransomware, are you aware that until very recently, ransomware was not illegal? It was illegal to extort money from someone.
Well, of course.
It's illegal to, but it wasn't necessarily illegal to install ransomware onto someone's system.
Wait a second. Isn't it illegal to hack somebody's device? What about the DMCA that we rant on about?
Yes, there is, but there wasn't actually something on the books to make that as part of the charges. You could talk about the effects of installing it, but the act of installing it wasn't necessarily covered on the books. So California, on January 1st of 2017, officially made installing ransomware illegal.
That's awesome. I had no idea that it wasn't.
I don't know if that's necessary, but okay.
Like I said, it adds another charge. It was that little hole in there going, well, just because it was installed, wasn't it? But the fact that it deprived someone of the use, that was a tort.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you were extorting money, that was obviously a problem, but not the actual installation.
So does California have jurisdiction in Eastern Europe where they're writing the ransomware?
You didn't even cover the part of the story about this smart TV, the LG TV being hit, that it pretended like it was FBI. The message was coming from the FBI. Why would they do that? Does it just make people more scared? It seems so odd.
Well, why would you report it to the FBI if the FBI is the one extorting it? Yeah. I don't know.
It's great.
You know, ransomware does everything and anything it can to get the money out of you. So nothing surprises me.
There may be some social aspect to this. Like, I don't mean social as in beneficial, but with regard to those old like Nigerian print scams, they had, you know, gross spelling and grammar errors, things like that. And people were like, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you spend more time to try to make it credible? And the rationale behind it is the people who are going to be skeptical of it.
You don't want them as a client.
That's not the breaking thing. They can laugh about it. But if you find the people that are ignoring the gross problems with it and still calling,
you're getting their money.
You're getting a sucker.
Yeah. It's so a pre-screen.
I'm wondering if there's some angle on it posting as FBI that was...
Yeah, interesting. I like that idea.
That is not what you would expect. It's some extra hook.
Well, a TV is an interesting target for ransomware because it's inherently opening the gates to people that are non-technical who, how are they even going to know how to buy Bitcoin and pay the ransom?
Yeah. They might not even have a computer. The thing about ransomware a TV, it's not like it's your precious photos or, you know, the medical records of an entire hospital like we've seen or police department medical records. It's just your TV. Like, you could buy a new TV. So now you're questioning or have LG charge you less.
You could buy a new TV. Come on. These are smart TVs. So you're talking about people shelling out, you know, $600 or something like that. But it's not a trivial purchase for most people. Thank you, Mr. Netflix engineer.
No, but the charge is $500 for the ransomware. I mean, it's almost the price of a TV. I guess that was a 50-inch LG. I mean, that's probably more like a $1,200 television, I would assume.
Well, it was 4K, enough that he definitely wanted to get control of it back.
Yeah. But so the thing is that I don't like is that if you pay a ransom, you have to assume that the criminal, who you shouldn't trust, you're going to trust them. Because all that can happen is like 3 months later, the ransomware comes back on. This time it's only $250. Come on. You really want to spend that $1,200 on your TV? Come on. It's only $200.
$30 Roku stick.
No, but that won't work because the TV just like it boots to the screen. You can't even use a Roku stick.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, you need to have a dumber TV. And then
right. It's ridiculous
add on
that
the smarts.
It's ridiculous that we're correlating the giant expense of this plasma screen or LCD screen to this really stupid computer that costs $14 to make that actually has the problem. Like, you don't need that computer. Like, you just need the screen.
Well, you just need the screen and you need a MHL port.
MHL?
Mobile High Definition Link.
Is that the 4K
it's an
link?
It's an HDMI connector. But it allows for a power to go to the device, And more of the two-way connection, so the CEC signals.
You could also plug the power in. You could provide power some other way to the stick. I know they all get power that way. But can the Roku actually handle a 4K signal?
I don't know if the stick can. I know that that there are Rokus that do handle 4K.
The 4K Ultra HD television Roku does.
Is it a stick?
Dun, 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 dun. It's a TV. Oh, Roku's making a TV. Interesting.
They do also have a device of memory service, but anyway.
But anyways, if there's any TV manufacturers just happen to be listening in instead of, I don't know, being at CES right now.
Roku 4. Roku Ultra. It's $130, and it does do 4K.
Ah. But if you guys are actually listening to the show, let me make a request for every geek in the world, because I will speak for us all now. Please make a simple TV that you can just take a box that we want to buy and replace as the TV ages, because those boxes are always going to be better.
CES has shown off a lot of really cool TVs.
Yeah?
The high dynamic range TVs are hitting the market now, and they're OLED. Organic
LED.
Yeah. And they're pretty. One of them, I want to say it was 2.5 millimeters thick. It's like paper on a wall. It's really cool looking.
And then Samsung, I believe, was doing a lot of headway with the QLED, the quantum dot.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently that is something that has complete dynamic range, where it's just like blackest blacks and still...
About a year and a half ago, I saw a demo of a high dynamic range from a company that I won't mention at work because it was private. I don't know if it's public yet. There was a window in the same room I was in. The window was closed because it's a theater. And we had this – it was only like 17-inch screen. It's really small, but it was in a big theater. And they're like, okay, so we watched some stuff about how it works and everything. And then they turned it on, and it was bright, like bright and beautiful and like stunning. And it just looked different than you'd expect it to look. And there was a shot of somebody in a building inside a barn kind of walking out the door and the sunshine in the background. It kind of hurt your eyes when you looked at it. And then the person that was there was like, you have a window in here? Open the window. And they opened the window, and the brightness outside was equivalent to the TV. It was crazy. And it was, so these TVs are going to be impressive. Much better than 3D technology. Blah.
This is the one who can't see 3D.
Shut up. I can see 3D.
It's okay. I'm with you. I don't like the 3D tech either.
3D sucks.
Have we ever talked about why 3D does not look good?
No. Have we? I don't know.
So
that matter why D-Box is just not worth the money?
Oh, my.
I actually went to use it for Rogue One. I was curious about it. I had never done it before, and I was like, oh, well, there's $10 gone.
Is it 10 extra dollars?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay, why is 3D TVs, why do they suck?
What would you say, Miles? 3D in general. The consumer 3D, either in theaters, TV, on a phone, on TV.
The reason for me why I don't care for 3D when I've watched it in theaters or tried to watch it on a screen with some special polarized glasses, that type of thing, is that in the real world where 3D – like that's what they're trying to do, is trying to immerse you in this world. You choose what you're focusing on.
Exactly.
And with the movies, they are – choosing where the point of focus is, and so when you're looking at someplace that isn't supposed to be the focus, suddenly you're like, wait, your eye isn't able to put the thing that you're not caring about out of focus.
Right. So not only do your eyes have to work harder because they're trying to make something to focus, which they have no control over, but as you look around, it breaks the illusion because all of a sudden the different layers of the 3D, there's not actual slices of layers, but the end effect is it feels like there's layers, and something that should feel three-dimensional because your eye can look around and realize that it can't pull that focus becomes sort of a flat thing moving through space instead of a real three-dimensional object.
Interesting. I of course can't see 3D. I don't have parallax, so these things don't like affect me, but it's interesting to hear you guys talk about the problem. I do see the problem more in, like, when I've seen 3D films, I do see the problem of the focal point. But I have to say that the focal range in television and movies exists all the time anyway. It's very common to have the background be blurry, and we just don't focus over there. So why is it different in 3D?
Because all of a sudden there is this 3D effect where your mind thinks, oh, I can focus this. I can look around where I want to.
Why doesn't our mind think we can focus it anyway on a 2D image that has a blurred background? I'm just wondering if this is because the TV does have more experience with a
because
flat
the
screen?
TV does not actually have depth. If you do have perception of parallax, you can see that it is a flat surface. It's like if you're looking at a photo, you can tell like there's
okay.
no.
Next time you guys see a 3D film, if you ever do again, in the screen when you got the polarized lens, or whatever, close one eye. Does it still look three dimensional to you?
No.
Right now it looks flat. Is that problem still there?
Some of it.
I've experienced films where that problem is still there, where it's like I want to focus on that, but I can't. It hurts. So there's something else about the technology. I'm just wondering if it's really about the technology boundary rather than the actual problem. Because
no, it is a technology boundary. You get cues about depth. Sorry, not you. we get cues about depth by looking at something, and there's all sorts of cues. The little slight head movement, there's parallax going on that you actually can perceive in objects that are a certain distance away from you.
Yeah, but keep in mind that in a 3D screen room where you have polarized lenses of that nature, you do not have movement back to back that will not cause the image to
shift. No, it won't.
It's only between the eyes.
And that breaks the illusion. You can't put your finger on why
so
the illusion
the
is broken.
Well, okay. There's also different ways that people perceive 3D. This is... We've talked about this in the past with regard to the differences or why many times women will get nauseous looking through 3D goggles, but men don't. It's because there actually is a difference in many cases of how the depth is perceived, where men will base it upon parallax, and if that's off, then that'll work. But with women, what they've been finding is that there's much more cue from the shadows, but there are multiple cues, and those may not be – that may be the strongest ones.
But the technology's been built by men mostly.
Well, not just that, but there are multiple cues there that when you just work off of the most naive models for mm-hmm. what makes 3D, there's so many other aspects to our perception that just haven't – been covered yet. I think there's a lot more to do with the science, and the science also needs to trickle down into the engineering, which is going to be a whole other long length of time to refine.
I would assume that VR stuff has the same kinds of problems.
Well, yeah, actually, I was wondering whether the we were talking at did it make it in the after show or the main show of last week's show about the foveated rendering?
That was a post show, yeah.
Okay.
Though when Maggie was listening to it, she said, "Why is this post show? This feels like the normal show." I'm like, "I don't know. We play the theme song at one point and then it goes off."
Our real fans listen to the whole thing. Anyways, so if they're doing eye tracking and if they could actually track the eye trying to focus, they could start to put that into VR. But I haven't seen any rendering that tries to track that.
For me myself, when looking at VR, like when I look in the goggles, it's been different for me because the models are so simplistic right now. It's kind of like playing an Atari 2600 game, the equivalent, compared to games today. And so your imagination fills in enough. It's a basic storytelling. Now that they're getting much closer to photorealism or as they move closer to that, you're going to hit that uncanny valley. And I'm wondering with the 3D technology for movies, if we've just hit that uncanny valley, even though it doesn't refer to like the movement of a human being type of thing. But
it's the same thing. Your perception and...
If it were off by more, if it were more stylized, or if it were more simplistic, you would accept it. You would go, no problem. But it's trying to say that this is real.
Right.
And there's something off.
Right. There's something breaking the illusion. And you were saying about in a regular 2D traditional film or television that sometimes you get the effect where you're trying to focus on something and it's a little unnerving to you.
No, I don't think that actually happens. In a 2D one, I'm saying that it forced location focusing is very common in cinema.
Yeah,
it
doesn't
everywhere.
Bug you.
I don't think it bothers anybody.
No. And part of that is now it's a film language.
It's probably because of the language. But, that's what I'm thinking. Is like we just don't have enough history with 3D potentially.
But the other part of that is film has never been really the illusion of something actually there.
Tell that to the people that first saw the train come through the screen. They freaked out. I mean, it is because we know of film. That's why it doesn't feel real to us, partially.
Okay, I got to think about that one.
No, it's a tough one. Let's move on. Miles.
Yes.
Let's talk about Apple and patents.
this story begins with a young woman who was driving the family car and was in an automobile accident. The reason for this accident was because she was trying to FaceTime someone, video chat with someone at the same time that she was driving.
Okay, so she's on an Apple phone, iPhone, video chatting with somebody and gets in an accident because she wasn't paying attention to the road.
Yes. Or rather, the driver of the car who hit them. I'm sorry, not the daughter.
So the daughter was killed because of another driver was FaceTiming.
Yes.
Okay. While they're driving.
Sorry for the mix-up there with the description. Sure. And so now a lawsuit is being filed against Apple because Apple patented a technology for detecting when you were, for example, driving, when you had a certain level of motion.
Okay.
And then deactivating certain features that would be contraindicative to paying attention to the road.
Like if they had implemented this patent, they filed the patent, but they could theoretically turned off the face cam, the video capabilities of FaceTime while driving.
Mm-hmm. Or the interface so you couldn't really interact with the phone or something, things like that.
So they actually patented this idea.
They patented it. But they never
What's the lawsuit about?
But they never implemented it.
They never.
And so what the lawsuit is how can you file for this patent back in 2008, but never actually implement it?
Oh, this is so interesting.
Right. And so it seems like, wait a second, how are you going to force someone to implement the patent? But at the same time, patents work that when you file for the patent, no one else can do that.
No. People can do it. They just have to pay you.
Well, they have to. Yeah. They have to.
Well, it does practically stifle innovation if somebody wants to implement it and feels like they're going to be sued or that they can't get the rights to pay, get the license.
Yeah, we rarely see the license request thing happening in courts. Like, it's possible to request that patent from Apple. Right. And say we want to license this patent.
But if you are a patent holder, you decide what the licensing terms are if you decide to license it at all. You don't have to.
Totally true. Okay, so aside from the fact, the thing is the person that was driving actually had an Apple device.
Yes.
It was an Apple device. It was their patent. They could have implemented it. In fact, they probably researched it and probably tried it.
Yeah. The lawsuit is stating that it was a substantial factor to the crash, that if this feature had been there, it would not –
So one way of thinking of this is they sold a feature that they knew potentially could have a problem while driving. They had a solution. They designed a solution. They patented the solution, but they didn't actually implement it. So in some ways, it's equivalent to not putting fire extinguishers inside a house, right? You know a fire can happen. We know how to handle the problem. We didn't put the fire extinguishers in the house. It's all our fault. We're potentially liable. But there's no actual law about turning off FaceTime. Unlike in a house, there's laws about having distinguishing systems.
Right, and Apple is not known for being a patent troll, or at least no more so than very large companies.
This isn't really about patents, is it?
Well, it is, because
a patent is just that they knew there was a problem here, and they had a solution for it. They'd thought about it. And therefore, because they thought about it and decided not to do it, they're responsible for not doing it.
But that's the rationale for a patent is that you are going to say, I have this idea. Now I want a monopoly on the idea for a limited period of time so that I can have the incentive to go through the manufacturing and the bug fixing and the tweaking.
Is it valid in a patent system to say, wow, here's this great idea I've got in manufacturing Zubzobs, and there's another company that manufactures Zubzobs, and though I don't want to start using this new way of doing it, I want to make sure they don't do it. So I'm going to file a patent and not grant them it and not even use it just to block its use from the industry.
Which has occurred,
and then 6 years later, when I'm actually ready to retool my engineering stuff, I'll implement this new patent. In some ways, that seems like a valid use of a patent. But that's not – there's definitely not –
Wait,
not the
a valid use of a patent
for a company?
Something that has occurred, it's a it's an effective strategy.
It's an effective strategy.
I don't know if it's necessarily –
Well, the
valid.
When I say valid, for the company, it makes a lot of sense for them to do it.
Right.
For the intent of why we have a patent system, it does not make any sense.
Right.
Is that fair? Is that,
yeah, no, yeah. That's exactly the point I was going to make.
But I don't think the patent is really the issue here. The patent is just about them under... They knew there was a problem with the system they designed.
Well, the reason why the patent's a part of this is somebody's trying to sue Apple for...
Not implementing the patent.
Well, putting the responsibility on Apple. And there is an understandable line of thought there in when you look at how if somebody has a patent, other people don't try to compete in that space.
Well, Apple has deep pockets, so that definitely is a factor. But I think you really touched on it, Lyle, with regard to if they file the patent with regard to talking about it being a lockout mechanism to prevent operation of one or more functions while operating vehicles, they recognize that there is a problem.
That's right.
So that the fact that they have recognized the problem, I believe, is the crux of their argument, that it's a liability.
Another way to think of this is when you use like the Waze app, which is a navigation tool, and the company that's make it, they want to limit their liability. And so they do have a disabled feature. And the only way you can re-enable it is saying, I'm a passenger. So everybody that's using this system, they're driving them by themselves. Mm-hmm. They just click the I'm a passenger button. And that alleviates Waze. Now Google actually owns Waze, I believe.
Yeah.
Well, ABC does. I don't know if Google
does. No, it's Google.
Google.
Yeah.
Alphabet, actually, sorry. I take that back. I forgot about Alphabet. I don't know.
It might be Alphabet. I don't know.
But no, it's owned by Google.
Yeah. Okay. Why do you know it's Google? Because Maps is under Google? Maps is not under...
They don't exist under their own umbrella corporation.
Okay. So, right, but ABC, Alphabet's the corporation, right?
The Alphabet is the umbrella corporation that... the umbrella. Wow. Okay.
Do we need to go here?
I did not mean to make that reference, but...
Wait, what's the reference of the Umbrella
Corporation? I don't get it.
That's from Resident Evil, the Umbrella Corp.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But anyway.
There's one person in the audience going, what do you mean? You didn't know that?
You know what? It's not important. So Waze says that, and therefore when someone gets in a crash because they were using Waze, Waze goes, yeah, but you said you were a passenger. You know, so you lied to our system. Right? We warned you. Apple does not warn when using FaceTime and driving. They're not doing that, right. Even though they knew there's a potential problem. They filed a patent about it and everything.
Okay, would that be triggered if you're in an airplane trying to FaceTime?
Well, yeah, or in a train.
If you could,
or in a taxi.
If you were able to FaceTime while you were on an airplane, like when it was in flight, congratulations.
Okay, so
no, actually, my point there though is that the reason why Apple may not have implemented this is it's still hard to determine whether you're in the car and whether you are the driver.
Yes,
I'm sure somebody's going to come up with a way to use the camera, use echolocation in the car to figure out where the walls are and determine you're the driver. But we haven't gotten there yet. So, in the interest of not turning off their users who are not the driver, they may not have implemented it.
Well, the other aspect of this, though, yeah, like on a bus or whatever, but the other aspect of this is that the person that was driving, you have to assume that because of the way Apple designed their system, they were tricking the driver into not understanding what their obligation was. It was Apple's responsibility that they were doing something inappropriate. I mean, the driver could have also been making lasagna in the front seat while he was driving, right? Well, like, there's a lot of things that could have been distracting.
I remember seeing a guy in L.A. playing the guitar while he was driving down the freeway.
Was it a convertible?
Actually, it was.
That guy's awesome. No, don't do that.
But it would be interesting. This is coming from the point of view of folks who are not necessarily enamored of software patents.
It feels like a big thing about software patents, and I don't see that.
Right, but I mean, taken from that point of view, taken from that lens, it is interesting if this were to come to pass where they would win their lawsuit, because then it would have an impetus from the company not to patent stuff unless they actually intend on implementing it.
Which would be kind of cool.
Well, this is a good time to bring up Greg made a point, which is maybe the other important thing to think about with patents. We see all the time that people are granted patents for very broad, not easily definable...
Business processes.
Business processes. And part of the problem is that our underfunded patent system just is not attempting to screen out many things that we think should be screened out. So...
Well, the way they get around it a lot of times is the patent is... You can't patent just mathematics. That was one of the bulwarks. But programming is kind of logic and mathematics. So the way around that was patents were done so that they say running on a computer
math.
Which is hardware. It's math. Therefore, and that was the end run around it.
So,
it hasn't
basically
been...
saying you can't patent 2 plus 2 equals 4, but 2 plus 2 equals 4 on a computer.
On a general
purpose
totally computer.
Patentable.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's horrible. Okay, so do you think that this is about patents? This story, Miles? How do you like the whole idea that you were taking before on this idea that Apple was potentially stopping other companies from disabling this or adding this disabling feature because of their patent?
Well, that is an aspect of patents that is problematic, I find, where you're able to file for a patent describing this thing but then never implement it, which means that there's an idea out there, because a lot of times many different individuals will all come across the same idea around the same time, just because society and or technology or
So let me ask you this. What if Android had a FaceTime thing, like Hangouts? Okay, so Google Hangouts is on Android device. Let's say it's installed on the Pixel phone. And so Google's responsible. They made the phone with Samsung, I think, and they give out this phone, and it's got software on there. And they wanted to disable it while driving, but Apple wouldn't grant them the patent. Then the family could sue Apple, right? Because Google intended to do all the right things, but Apple was blocking them because of their patent.
That would be a better
way of saying the patent system's wrong, and this case proves it. I don't see how the patent system's actually at fault in the death of this girl. I don't see how it's connected, really.
Right. And as I said, I think you had a better point, which is the liability issue, that they knew that it was an issue
and
chose not to do anything about.
And I still think that could help in reducing fraudulent patents. Are they not called fraudulent patents? Superfluous patents? Ridiculous patents?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it would be nice if all of a sudden people are held accountable for not implementing patents that they filed. That's kind of cool. Just to find all the crazy patents where you can take people
or
out.
To give an actual justification for it, yeah.
Yeah. It seems to me that the best way to go about fixing the patent system is saying you can patent things that you actually implement. Like, you can't patent if it's not implemented.
Yeah, there's still the argument of software patents.
Well,
why?
Yeah, the whole idea of the patent system. What is it? 14 years? 7 years? The time cycle is so different than the way software works, which is more appropriate for, I don't know, 6 months or something like that.
Software is also more akin to something like copyright. Like, you don't want to have someone do the exact way they did it, but at the same, like, you don't want to copy someone's work on a test. But if you are able to answer the questions on the math test, but in using your own method, you know, doing your own way or independently of how they were doing it, then that seems more legitimate.
I mean, software is algorithms and language. Those things shouldn't be patentable. I mean, that's what it is, right? It's
Expression of logic. I don't know about language. We talk about programming languages, but there's still
expressions
of logic.
I was thinking about patterns.
Okay.
Like computer patterns. I think of this as language, but maybe they're not language. Maybe
design patterns, that seems more like a collection of things that you use as a shorthand for a proof, that type of thing, where it's a collection of items.
Yeah, the reason I call it – I mean, I'm not talking about programming languages. I'm talking about every program is technically its own language in the sense that it has its own dialect and descriptions, but that's
– I love you guys are discussing this. When you both retweeted my tweet this week about how I thought my lack of advanced math was going to be a problem with programming, and here it was – English skills are far more important to writing good, clean code.
Absolutely.
So, and it is language.
Yeah.
No, I actually took that as needing to write documentation, but that's a whole other conversation.
Oh, really?
That's bad code if you need that much documentation.
Yeah, you don't need
documentation. No. Oh, come on. Oh, you guys are killing me.
I'm baiting you.
This is something I talked about in the past where in a job role that I had, people were like, you know, you have to have tests. You have to have your unit tests. You have to have your functional tests to make sure. And I'm like, so where's the documentation? Oh, well, just look at the code. Well, it tells me the implementation. It doesn't tell me the intention, like what you were trying to do. It just tells me how it was actually implemented. What is the API that you want me to call? Because there's a whole bunch of function calls there that seem obviously not meant to be for public use. They're supposed to be just a quick utility internally.
Okay, I totally agree that you should have documentation. But...
And for some reason, there is this, because maybe it's not as fun, but there's a whole mantra there saying, like, if you can't write unit tests, you are not a good software engineer. But if you can't write documentation, oh, sorry, no, there are tech writers out there who are really good at this. And if you're not, then, oh, yeah.
Yeah, but you don't have to be a good writer to write good documentation about your application.
Well, you don't have to.
If you designed a pattern, you're deciding to do something, you should be able to describe what that is and what's going on with it.
Right. You don't need to write the most elegant test to be able to. You know, you don't have to look at your unit test and go, oh, that was some really clean code.
No, you're like, spending, if you have clean code in your unit test, you have a problem. There should be dupe, copy, change variables around.
Right. So the documentation should still be like, this is what I'm trying to do, and this is how this goes in, and this is a quick blurb of how you should be interacting with my system. Like, if you can't do that, you have some serious issues with
Miles,
your communication skills.
You're still working on the new Netflix. The new GeekSpeak infrastructure stuff for the Postgres system you're doing. Mm-hmm. Are you writing documentation as you go?
Yes.
Can we see it?
You can see the things that are attached to the schema right now. I still haven't written that thing that dumps out.
Okay.
The comments along with the.
And are you writing unit tests?
I am trying to.
What do you mean trying to?
Because I. I'm still in. I have some tests that don't go anywhere. Like, do I get back a homepage? Yeah, okay, I got back a 200 status code, but what's supposed to be the content in there? Oh, I'm not sure where that's supposed to be.
All right, so you kind of stubbed out you've got a lot of failing tests right now.
Yes.
Yeah. And Brian, in your software development work you're doing, are you writing unit tests?
Unfortunately, no. No, I'm not doing that right now.
How does?
I want to be. Well, I want
arms,
to. I'm trying to write
arms,
them.
Your arms crossed tighter, and your lips got tight. Your face got all serious.
It's a gaping hole in my current programming.
Yeah.
Part of it's some hard networking related stuff to write unit tests for. But I need to learn to do that.
Yeah, we write a lot of functional tests at Netflix actually because the data flow is so large, and we're UI people, so we actually write tests that render content at the very edge and test whether that stuff got rendered correctly going all the way back down our stack, which means we have to have all the sample data. So we're constantly making these fake episodes of television shows that have pictures of our dogs and stuff in them and using that as our truth, if you will. But anyway, let's move on. Let's talk about PDFs. Just get a little simple on the Mac for a second before getting this last story, which I think is kind of long. So,
oh yeah. So, this is just a public service announcement to all the Mac users out there. We were talking about the we weren't talking about the scanner because that was in the last show we didn't record. Sorry, in an alternate reality, we were talking about my SnapScan scanner, and
you brought up that you collect old computers and you can never get rid of them and you can't throw them away, including like an old Mac and an old scanner. And then you said, actually, you figured out that the Mac couldn't run on the new operating system you've got?
It's the scanner. The scanner is a really old scanner. I love this scanner and I have no reason to throw it away, but I can't run it on my current OS. So the driver of it just simply doesn't work with the latest OSs. Turns out that I saved a Mac Mini from a year before when my company was throwing it out. And I said, no, you cannot do that. And I was easily able to set that up. And now I have a dedicated Mac Mini running the scanner. Well,
wait, what are you scanning?
Paper. They keep sending me paper.
Fair enough.
The gas company leaves paper on my door. It's the only way I know how much was put into the tank versus the other tank.
I thought you used like Moneywell and things like that, you can just use your phone and take a picture of things.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But you cannot see the exact dimensions of the scan. The scanner knows exactly how many inches by how many inches the thing is. And it can scan like 10 sheets at a time. Just put in the sheet feeder and it goes, and it's great. You can't do that with the phone.
Yeah. And then you always get the parallax problem where the phone like isn't getting exactly square.
And you get the shadow of your hand over it. That bugs me.
Yeah. You definitely want those scans to be perfect. Okay.
When I go back and I look at the legal documents I've scanned, I'm happy.
I bet.
And so the reason why all this came up is that when Sierra, the latest Mac operating system, came out, other people had problems with their SnapScan scanners that were recent enough and they can use the driver. The problem they were running into is when they opened up the PDF generated by their scan, sometimes they run it through an OCR process and it puts in a layer of OCR.
Optical character recognition.
A text layer so that you can do search your scanned images for text. Well, the latest versions of the OS, when you open it up in preview and save it out, it erases that layer, just completely obliterates it. So your OCR is gone. But it turns out that there are many, many more problems that are deep into the operating system related to PDFs.
Why are you opening the PDFs and resaving them in preview?
Oh, you could do a note. You could add some annotations. Yeah.
Rotate it, yeah. Something like that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, lots of rotating.
Anytime you save with preview, it just destroys the data.
It'll destroy that layer. But there's many more problems that have been discovered as well. And it all comes down to a core library called PDFKit within the operating system. We haven't gotten into the whole topic of Macs and how they seem to be a little bit languishing in the Apple universe, have we?
No, we haven't.
Yeah, that's a huge, long topic.
It is.
But to let's just say this is a mark of what's going on with Apple these days, because apparently what they were doing is they have had PDF libraries for both iOS and the Mac, and they wanted to unify those. So they moved the iOS PDF kit over to both systems, but they apparently released it before they finished adding enough of the features in that it could fully replace the previous Mac version.
For a slight defense of Apple in this situation and the developers working on that project, the PDF standard is friggin' crazy insane. Do you know that PDF, the actual PDF spec, does 3D images? You can have full 3D modeled images in there. So,
which is funny, because when Pixar made RenderMan, they were modeling it after PostScript, which is what PDF comes from.
Yeah, I mean, PDF is this big, giant, bloated format. I can kind of imagine it being difficult to re-implement it. And also, OCR layer, I'm assuming there's multiple ways of saving layers. Like, there's an annotation layer as well. I'm assuming that these are similar things.
There are. It just happens to be the feature that they were using in the old PDF kit was no longer implemented in the new PDF kit. A lot of things were deprecated.
Yeah. When you open a PDF file on your computer, let's say you're on your Mac, and you open a PDF, how does it feel? How do you feel about it emotionally?
What are you getting at?
I want to know if I'm matched with the same feeling of PDFs. What do you feel about it? Do you like, PDFs, yes.
Or do you come up and go, I have no emotional attachment to the format.
Nothing? It just opens up and you're like,
I'm like, okay, there's my check. Okay, yeah, there's the pay stub.
You're looking at receipts? It's always scanned receipts that you made. That's awesome.
Oh, no, sometimes it's my kid's homework.
Okay. Miles, what about you?
I used to hate PDFs because they would, the Adobe plugin would just send your computer ground to a halt while you watched a little progress bar and you just sat and waited.
Because it was processing looking for 3D images as well.
Finally, the first page would come up and then you're like, okay, so I'm going to scroll down. Oh, they're all blank. Oh, wait, now the text is like, it was a painful experience. Now that it is no longer an Adobe plugin, now that it has been re-implemented within Chrome, within WebKit, within Firefox, usually as JavaScript libraries, they've actually been far more responsive. I don't necessarily like them as much as the straight web experience, but they're meant for a different thing. They're meant for print. Mm-hmm. So it's logical for me to add them, like, for example, when you get free downloaded ebooks. Have them as PDFs and then put them into my reader and have them. It's not ideal. I would much rather they be like EPUB format. But I don't have as strong a negative reaction as I used to.
Have you ever been like looking through old photographs of family members and stuff, like grandparents and great-grandparents? You're like, oh, cool, I remember this picture, whatever. And you pick it up and you realize like there's a crease along it that hasn't like ripped up the front of it, but it definitely is fragile enough that you've got to be careful with it. And now you're holding this thing in your hand where you're like, well, I can look at this picture, but it's not exactly the way I want it, and I'd like it to be better.
I want this in a different format. Let's scan it.
PDF seems. Every time I open it, I'm like, oh, okay, it's not broken right now.
It really feels that fragile to you?
Yeah.
Because it's been like the bedrock of my organizing onto my digital life.
I can't stand PDFs. And the other aspect is that, you know, someone sends you like, hey, fill out this form for me. And they send, you know, the doctor.
Okay,
and they're like,
yeah.
I want to fax it to you. You're like, what? No, email it to me. So they don't send you a web form. They send you a link and you click on the link. And instead of it being a web form, it's PDF and you download it and it's got form fields in it. So you're like, cool, I'll fill out the form. before I print it and send it to them through the mail or bring it in. So then you go and you start typing in the form fields, and they're always the wrong size. They don't really work. You're like,
well,
why am I doing
PDF
this?
PDF done well is amazing for
it's
that.
It's also mythical.
No, I've come across it before where a PDF comes in and you're supposed to sign a document, and you are able to do a signature onto a PDF, and you're filling out forms, and you're able to do click and it initials it, and it is something that is legally binding. You have this thing that has a cryptographic signature associated with it when you're done.
That's all built into the PDF format too, as well.
Yes,
really? There's crypto
yes,
in there?
Yes.
Yep. And you send it back, and you're done.
And form submission. A PDF can send itself to a web service. Do you know that?
What? It's a self-sending form?
You can make a PDF, and as you fill it out and you say save, it will submit a package to a service. The PDF format supports that.
Okay. Yeah. Have you ever seen that implemented?
Yes! I've implemented it!
So what you're talking about... Yeah, what PDF is basically the...
Kitchen sink.
Well, it's a browser. And so when you open up a PDF in a browser, it's a browser within a browser. The PDF format is basically implementing all the things that you would expect from a browser.
Yeah.
The layout, the different file formats, the positioning, the fonts, and the network connections,
PDF,
the encryption.
PDF was supposed to support the idea of printing a document, right? It doesn't need to have a form in it. It doesn't need to have 3D rendering in it.
Well,
it doesn't. Like, that is that's
exactly the rationale that people had for. There shouldn't be any JavaScript. You should have – that's what a web page is, content, and it should just
– Why are people sending images and – why are people sending images and emails? I mean, that's just taking up a lot of bandwidth.
I mean, I get that you make the document and it's print – it's like an 8.5 by 11. You can print it and you know, it's perfectly the same. But to me, it always seems slightly broken. And the thing is, Miles, when it works well, when have you had a PDF that actually did exactly what you just described, that actually functioned correctly?
It's
Who
rare,
made
but then again, I don't do interactions with PDFs all that
That's
often.
That's right.
But
unless you're Brian, you use a PDF like once every 3 months. Somebody sends
actually
you something.
Actually, the IRS tax forms as PDF are pretty legit.
You don't pay. You don't pay TurboTax.
This was years ago.
So what? Format would you use to represent a scanned document other than PDF?
Well, I don't think
there's a reason for this. You could use TIFF, could hold multiple pages.
Oh, don't get me started on the TIFF
yeah,
format.
Yeah,
no,
which format?
Wait, Brian, what do you think's inside the PDF that's that scanned?
I know.
That's what it is a TIFF that's inside the PDF.
I know. At least they decided on one version of TIFF.
No, they didn't. They didn't, because PDFs can support every image format you could possibly imagine. Oh, it's a horrible format. I mean, PDF clearly is the worst kitchen sink bloatware format that's ever existed.
So
it probably will exist
like a browser.
Forever. Yeah, but a browser, at least there's like a standard and it gets better over time.
PDF has had nothing but standard. You were just talking about the PDF spec. Like, it has had a published spec.
Yeah, but the people that work
for
online
years,
actually,
for decades.
But working on the internet feels good. Working on PDF feels like you're working for Adobe. It's just this. Blah.
Well, okay. So you're just a bigot then.
No, when the consortium that controls PDF, if you will, is it a consortium? Is Adobe owning it?
It used to be Adobe. I think Adobe farmed it off so that the spec is no longer. I mean, Adobe's on the governing board, but I don't think it's controlled by Adobe.
If you want to make a document that creates a form and digitally signing that form, you are buying software to make that document. You are buying software from Adobe or some other vendor that has this product that does it well. And some mom and pop shop that needs help with their systems and sends out a PDF, like even a school district, does not have the money to spend to buy,
now,
to make
the
forms.
Bear in mind, this is exactly the same dilemma that people had with Microsoft Word.
Yeah.
Exact same tax.
Sure.
And there was a time when that was just you pay that tax. And Adobe was in direct competition with Microsoft with regard to print publishing.
Who won?
We
all lost is all I know.
I now know the prank you're going to get. I'm going to fill your Drobo up with every version of PDF I can find.
Well, now you have Google, which just gives you ads, and then you or you can pay for their Office Suite. But
Brian, do you really like PDFs? You actually like the format?
I don't care about the format. I like my scans.
Yeah, when I do have a when I do make a purchase online, for example, through some event, I'm buying plane tickets, for example, and it gives you the confirmation screen with all your stuff.
Yeah.
I will go print, save as PDF.
Sure.
I do that all the time.
It's the only way I make create PDFs is that exactly that format. Because it's a good way to get a copy of what and not have paper, because paper sucks. All right. Maybe we need to move on to end the show, or should we do this last story?
I've been waiting on this last story, so it's...
All right.
This was supposed to be our long-form story, too.
This was the one we... Well, it's been an hour and 20, and we've done it twice. All right. My sister had renal failure, kidney failure, at 13, and then got a transplant from my father, and then a transplant... After she lost that, had a transplant from my sister, and has had two cadaver transplants. So this topic, to me, is very interesting and important, and so please do lead in with this.
Okay. So... First off, self-driving cars. They're going to change everything. I mean, they're changing the way we look at taxis, changing the way we look at ownership. But they do have wide-ranging social consequences that people haven't really thought about as much. And we've talked about in the past what happens to people who work in the shipping industry when all the freight trucks are self-driving. You have the class issues of what happens when the rich people can all buy the new car that's driverless, and then they take away all personal liability for getting from point A to point B, but the people who have to buy the have to keep their existing car that isn't self-driving still have that legal liability and have to get the car insurance, you know, that type of thing. Well, now there's another wrinkle, which is right now the primary method of getting organ donations is through car accidents. Self-driving cars are supposed to make us much more safe and make accidents far more rare. We've already seen this with stories with Tesla driving along, and it saw a car accident happen with a car in front of it before, not even with its own car, and came to a halt before it became a problem. Like, we're already seeing the technology get to that point where
we'll almost eliminate car accidents is basically what's going to happen. If we get rid of all human drivers, we'll almost won't have any car accidents anymore.
Right. This is
– which is a fundamental change in our society. Because
right. This is DeepMind's AlphaGo assigned to driving your car instead of playing a board game. And so you're talking about – the major pool where you get organ donation going away, disappearing.
And another way of thinking of this is we're going to shift deaths from people that are having, you know, kidney or liver failure or any other heart failure to people – they will be dying more than the people that are just averagely driving.
So instead of people coming to an accidental sudden death in some car accident, there will be an illness that will predictably take their life.
Yeah. And is
and when I said most, I actually need to rephrase that. It's 1 in 5 organ donations come from a victim of vehicular accident, but that's still
1 in 5.
Yeah,
that seems kind of low. Well, first off, you have to swap. You got to. I mean, kidney transplants, as I said, are potential. You know, you've got two of them, so you can donate. So those you have to pull those out of the story at some point. It's like heart. You know, heart have to be from accidental death, right? Mm-hmm. You can't find someone that's got severe cancer and use that heart again, right? That won't work. Lots of diseases that have killed the first person means that the organs are no longer available. So accidents are pretty much the only way, I think. What other ways besides car accidents do we?
Well, I mean, people have a lot of accidents outside of the car, but,
right? So falling off a ladder, things like that,
right? But that's still talking about 32,000 lives every year. Are lost on the highway.
Right.
Which is a staggering number. Like how...
Speaking of ladders, by the way, most dangerous tool you have. Be really careful with ladders.
But I mean, that's...
What's your car?
1% of, 1% of the nation gone.
Every year.
Every year. Due to car accidents. Just due to car accidents.
So the reason I brought up my sister is that...
Oh, I'm sorry. I have that way off order of magnitude.
Yeah, there's a lot more deaths.
320 million...
Yeah, it's 0.01.
Yeah. Sorry, 0.01.
So some quick numbers. 123,000 people need transplants every year. 6,500 die waiting for a transplant that has not come to them. And you were going to talk about your sister.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the reason I brought her up is that I wanted to like buffer myself from being the jerk that I'm about to be. Isn't it better that we don't have people accidentally dying in our streets and potentially sometimes having those organs work for other people?
Well,
I mean, it seems like it's a bad trade. It's a bad trade that our society makes right now in saying, well, 30,000 people will die this year and some of those people will save. How many people will live because of those?
Well, that's assuming the people that – there's a percentage of the drivers, of course. Like if you have a traumatic enough accident that – it's usually people that survive the accident but die en route to the hospital or the like where they aren't totally –
it's also – yeah, it's motorcycle – like instant brain death, right? It's a common one. And of course, one death can give the life to six different people, right? You've got multiple organs that you can do. In fact, if you – gave the control to the robot overlords, you might just start seeing people get sacrificed left and right because you can save so many more people that way.
Right. But their estimates are 94% of motor vehicle accidents involve some kind of driver error. So we are really talking about effectively taking away, you know, one out of 20 would still occur.
Right.
And the other 19 times, there's no accident.
So what's the fix? How do we get out of this problem that we're going to have fewer and fewer donations, even if they're not planned donations?
Well, one possibility is that you're going to end up with more black market. You're going to end up with more assaults.
You will end up with more black market.
Yeah. But it's also a plea to folks to say, like, hey, fill out the donor card.
Do it now.
Well,
because of all the other ways that you could die, and the thing is, we're a dynamic system. The standards for what we have for acceptable organs is based upon the current supply.
Right.
If you change that and go like, well, this person's going to die, or they can have the heart of a 70-year-old. It's not ideal, but it's going to be better than.
And we have
nothing, even if you're 20 years old.
And we have other – I mean, there are other researches going on, right? Growing organs, potentially, you know, having a harvest of – what is it? What's the blood type that's a universal donor? O positive?
O negative.
O negative. Having an O negative form, if you will, of hearts waiting where you've kind of grown them in a petri dish kind of situation and you're just ready to go for people.
That pig hearts.
Yeah. At some point in the future, we'll – be at that space, right? We won't need to take from an existing person. It makes more sense to do it that way at some level, right?
Well, we're still a ways off from that, but
absolutely,
we do have pig hearts.
Well, are they used?
It has been done before, yes.
Huh. Cool.
So we have
it's not in wide use. No,
why not?
I
would assume
there are ethical questions. There are pathogen questions and. There hasn't been the perceived need as yet, but you take away all car accidents and
there's also, I mean, rejection complexities are pretty big, and interspecies complexities, I'm sure, are even more complex.
Yeah, pigs are pretty compatible with humans. Really? They're amazingly so.
I've seen a lot of pigs walking around on the street.
That's just mean. You shouldn't talk about Miles that way.
So I take something different from this story. You know, we've got a technological solution that's causing a technological problem. We've got the solution to humans being bad drivers and autonomous cars are going to eventually replace us as the drivers. So that's the technological solution. We have other tech, medical tech, that will hopefully become a solution for people that need donors. But there's another issue here, which is we're creating things and we need to be coming up with these creations with some sort of thought behind how it's going to affect society and how it's going to play its part in how it's going to change society. There's an ethical component to making an autonomous vehicle, more than just who it chooses to hit or not hit in an accident.
Well, that's the thing, though. People have talked about that ethical dilemma. Who does it hit someone or does it not hit? And that's fine to talk about, except that what we're finding is that the driverless cars, you don't have to make that choice. They actually see the environment and...
But my point is the bigger ethical issue there is how it's going to change society in all these ways, in jobs, in available donors, in how we're going to have less need for wide roads because it'll efficiently use the roads we have.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Current two lanes will become three lanes.
Yeah, less bobbing and weaving.
Yeah, think of all the parking lots that will not be needed in cities. There's huge changes that will come from a successful autonomous fleet.
With that one holdout that's messing up the flow, that one Will Smith character from iRobot, he's like, no, I don't trust it. I'm going to drive manually. At these speeds, are you crazy?
But I mean, we were talking about AI, and what you saw was the threat of AI is that all the wealth will go to people who are able to build such an efficient system that it takes over. Economically and societally. I mean, we have to, as we make these creations, try to project ahead with some empathy on what this creation will become.
Well, that's what the universal basic income is trying to address, that type of things. But
that's the solution that we need. But the
well,
the
that's one that possibility. We will
plan,
that's, yeah.
The idea that we will plan a society out that will, you know, positively influence everybody. It's not.
It's so Star Trek.
It hasn't happened in the past. So,
right.
Yeah. I did, you know, because we were talking about my sister and that, I want to talk about the machine she brought into the house because she travels with her kidneys. She just has a big box for them.
She travels, most of us travel with our kidneys.
Yeah.
Her kidney dialysis machine.
Yeah. Excuse me, singular for me.
I just call it, he only has got one. We just call it her kidney. It's just a big box, you know, it's a big machine. Lots of boxes, actually. But this machine it's portable. Like, she had to carry it on the plane. It's like 140 pounds. It's, you know, we had to buff it around. But she just was able to do it all herself, hemodialysis, sort of blood circling through this machine. And she just does it every day of her life. And it is...
Every other day of her life.
Every other day, every day of her life. No, it's just that she has to think about it every day. Like, it's a constant thing, right? And when, I mean, she travels only, it's rarely. But that works at all is amazing. Like, it's... Mm-hmm. And it does work, you know?
Except for when you have to repair it.
We just had missing parts. I just had to make some extra parts for her. Yeah. Not a big deal.
Mountains. Oops, I left part of my kidney at home. What am I going
really
to do?
What happened. And that technology will just get better over time, right? So at some point, artificial kidneys will be a solved thing. Whether they're grown organically or not, whether they're implanted, it will happen. We're going to have a fleet out there. It's going to be years before that fleet is completely taking over, right? We're not going to be doing this next year. It's going to be 20 years before there are no more car accidents.
Well, that's the question, because how long does the average person keep a car? If they're leasing, 3 years?
The average car is on the road for 11 years.
Yeah, so that's the average. You have some folks who just keep their cars until they fall apart, and you have some folks that are on that, you know, 3 or 4 year lease over and over again.
See,
and the average ends up being about 10 years. So... Yeah, if you have the choice and the prices were similar, I don't know that they will be, but if the prices were similar, you're still talking about 10 or 20 years actually seems plausible.
You know, one of the things that delayed me doing Geek Speak over the break was I don't have the commute time I normally have, because I commute to work on a shuttle and it takes about 40 minutes. And on that shuttle, I edit Geek Speak. I get all this extra time because somebody else is driving. It's a human driving me. Mm-hmm. But eventually, everyone will have that kind of time in their vehicles to have this, you know, extra bit of time every day that they don't currently have.
And you also have the option for the cars. Everyone in the car is facing each other.
Right.
Yeah, the ones in back of the seats are facing forward. The ones in forward are facing backward. And the ones that are facing backward are probably safer.
I've worked at Netflix for 3 years. I commute every day, twice a day. I've had 7 conversations. Like, people don't talk during the commute. But, oh, that, okay, anyway.
Quite unlike my experience really with the Google. Although the Google Santa Cruz bus was very unusual, apparently. Many other buses, no one ever talked to each other or was very muted. But the Santa Cruz bus, everyone knew each other and we chatted.
Well, I don't engage conversations because I get episodes to edit.
So. Better getting longer and longer.
Yeah, as we speak. Okay, well, I think...
But I'm happy we did this show. Happy we did this this story, because I think it is...
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, this kind of... I guess it's a bad side effect.
One way that countries have offset some of the drop-off, or at least increased the number of available organs for transplant, is they've implemented an opt-out system for transplants rather than an opt-in. Currently, the U.S. is opt-in. And a lot of people don't opt in. If you have a greater need and you have more people that are going without organs, you're going to see probably a bigger public outcry
In the U.S., we are an opt-in currently. Please do opt-in. It's important. It saves people's lives. I know it's a horrible thing to think, like, wait, I don't want to die. Yeah, but that has no correlation to whether you're going to die or not.
Well, a lot of people have the ick factor. I don't want someone cutting into me and, you know, the feeling of personal violation, even though you are not really there to experience it.
Yeah, but does that really outweigh the benefit of giving somebody more lease on life? Well, so everybody has to ask themselves that question.
It's an emotional argument for a lot of folks, and it's still very personal. And when you have all the feels, you're not thinking about what is the cost-benefit analysis. You're going, oh, I don't know. And that's... And so a lot of people, even if they're sympathetic to it, if you have that indecisiveness, just like voting, turns into you don't make any choice rather than making, you know, the good or the bad choice.
What does it take right now to be on the donor list? I mark a card with my license. But
yeah, I did the same thing.
And I believe you can put that in your – can you put that into iOS's health information. There's the emergency health information that'll come up. There's the emergency information that'll come up.
We all turned off our phones, so...
Exactly. I was going to look at that.
Geekspeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and Geekspeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know we made it. I want to thank Miles Elam and Brian Young for joining me today.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
And also Greg Merkley, who gave us our working title for today. Thanks, Alexa. Go sue my car. Also, thank Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song, and thank you for being here for episode 0 of season 17. Anybody else got any posty showsy stuff?
There are many times where coding is not necessarily straightforward, but still, you know, there's forward progress.
Yeah, you know what you're going to do next.
But I mean, if you're just like making a website or making some app, a lot of times it's variations on a theme. You're not blazing some new ground. You're going like, okay, well, this is how we did it the last time, and this is the API we were using last time, and this is, you know, the graphics theme we were using last time. This is where things were interacting the last time, and you have a few novel concerns that you have to work out, and that's how it goes. I've been finding by kind of bucking the trends in making the Geekspeak website, over-engineering it, I keep running into these things. It's like, wait, why doesn't that work? Oh, because no one else thought to use it this way. Like, it just
are you talking about Postgres, or are you talking about...
No. I mean, yes, there is Postgres, but that actually has been rock solid for me. I've been nothing but
what
happy
is it,
about
what's
it.
The, what have you found? What problem?
So I need to make that database connection, and then I get back a JSON result. And then I'm calling Mustache on that JSON result and giving back an HTML template. But I don't want to duplicate the header and the footer on each template and make sure they stay in sync. I would like them to be able to have a template and then say include standard header, include standard footer, include that. So that I was like, okay, so how do I do this?
You're saying the JSON payload won't have that. The template itself will have that. The Mustache template.
Well, just talking about the header and the footer.
Of the entire page?
The entire page. So your basic menu items at the top, the copyright at the bottom, that type of thing. That stuff that really is common to all pages. And so I was thinking, okay, so Nginx is going to be doing this. That's the layer where this template conversion is happening. Oh, wow, here's something I haven't used in a really long time, server-side includes.
Mm-hmm.
So I just grabbed the file, I have server-side includes, and it translates, and I did some speed tests on it. I'm like, wow, that's really fast.
Yeah, no, server-side includes are awesome.
That's on the order of like 2 to 4 milliseconds on my virtual machine. That's going to fly. That's...
You know, it's something I regularly recommend to people when they want to do just that kind of thing, like a templated website. Mm-hmm. So you, server-side includes. Like, what are you going to think about, like a WordPress? I'm like, no, if you're coding HTML and you just want to have your navigation always be the same, use a server-side include. It's much easier.
Yeah.
And, of course, you don't have to use SHTML. You can remap HTML if you want, or a whole entire directory. Anyway, go on.
Right. Or in the case of Nginx, you can actually just say a specific location pattern, right. Which I have for templates to make sure the templates...
I'm not sure I understand.
I pushed the scary button on my laptop. Sorry. Go on.
Right, which is something that happens, you know, when I'm working with it, I want to have it so that the templates are not user visible. So someone can't look and see how our logic works, but I still want them to be accessible from the system. So Nginx has a great feature called internal. If it's called internally, great. So I'm calling a mustache template, so I'm using it with Lua.
Oh, and you want the server-side include to happen after the mustache process, after Lua processes it into an HTML document.
No, I want the template to, before it's been processed, just as HTML, and then have a bunch of includes, put them in, and then... do the JSON transformation and go output. And
wait, who's doing the final stitch?
The final stitch.
The sorry. Final. Okay, so you've got your fragment coming from Lua from the JSON in the mustache template, and then you've got headers and footers. Is there an overarching document? And what is that? The headers and the footers are server side includes, right? Where's the main HTML document?
I'm talking about the template that would be the mustache template
mm-hmm.
before Lua gets to it.
Got it.
It calls an Nginx location.
And pulls together.
Nginx location.capture. Nginx.location.
And does the server-side includes then.
Yes.
Then that is a template that then Lua uses to stitch in the JSON
right.
mustache template. Okay.
Right. It's not
so you're,
it's not an overarching handle every solution, but it seemed like it was a pretty elegant,
a valid way
simple
of going.
Solution. Yeah.
And so the problem you have is?
The problem I have is for some reason, if I take away the internal flag – and I call the template directly, it works fine. Server-side includes works fine. If I tell Lua to call Nginx location capture, which has worked for everything, every Nginx module I've ever come across or used thus far, it works except server-side includes. For some reason, server-side includes just don't fire. They don't
because
work.
Because it's internal only.
Yeah. Well, not because it's been flagged internal, just because it's an internal call. But other modules are called. Other filters are called. Not server-side includes.
Interesting.
I wonder if there's something on module loading order, or I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Or it could be that server-side includes are just so old and crusty. And,
no one's checking.
And
that's
also,
just not cool.
Well, that and they tend to be standalone. People tend to use server-side includes as, here's my HTML and I just want a
right.
simple header footer.
Right, it's like if you go any more extended, you're not going to use server-side includes anymore, kind of.
Right, done. But it seemed like the perfect solution for what I was looking for, but...
And you're not sure how much data you actually want to move into the database, right? Like, the navigation structure could be in the database instead.
I could do that.
You could also have Lua be writing to a file, and the end file has a server-side include call, and then have Nginx be serving a file.
Yeah, I can have Lua do the transformation and do the injections and stuff like that, too. I thought about that. One of my goals with this, and this is the whole over-engineering thing, was trying all these different methods to try to find the most intuitive, simple way to configure and use it. So that when you looked at it, you went like, oh, yeah, that's how that works. You know, try to avoid the cocoon issue that we had a decade ago.
I still want to hurt you from that. But
it was really cool.
You're saying you're making
Separate
so
went down all the time.
You're going to say
no,
the cocoon one was pretty stable. Yeah.
Oh, that was a pre-version?
Oh, man.
How many generations are we on now?
We had two versions of cocoon. We had an XML version and a
database version.
JSP
yeah.
version that connected to the database. And then we had... We're in the second version of Ruby on Rails app. So, and then we had a flat file system. So probably 5 different versions of GeekSpeak. But it's been
16 years.
16 years.
Yeah.
But Miles, are you saying you want to make it so intuitive you don't need to write documentation?
No, I'm not saying that at all. In fact, one of the things I want that I'm in the process of writing is sketching out different outlines for how did I make this? And because there are a few things I'm doing that, like, I look online, like, I can't get help because no one else is doing this.
You're the one to write the blog post.
Right. Awesome. But at the same time, like, I feel encouraged because I keep trying these different things. Wait, like, I've had an end-to-end now where I call it – it make, when I don't use a service I'd include, when I just have the entire page written out.
What was saying, you have one mustache template which Lua calls and mixes in the JSON, which, of course, the JSON's coming from Postgres, from actually a relational data structure, and then outputs an HTML document of those things stitched together.
Right.
That works. You can do...
Yes. And cool. What I thought was great was the fact that I'm doing this on my laptop, calling a virtual machine because I'm playing with Nginx configurations there, which then calls through my laptop's wireless to my Raspberry Pi that's running the PostgreSQL database, and the whole thing comes back to me in somewhere between 1 and 200 milliseconds. Considering
why
the hardware...
Is the Raspberry Pi involved? Speaking of over-engineering.
Well, because I actually wanted something that was up all the time. That's why the bot is still... The Geekbot is still running from Slack.
Oh, the Geekbot's running on Slack off of the Raspberry Pi?
Yeah.
Nerd.
But the other issue was that I wanted to develop off of an underpowered machine, because it would make any performance problems more pronounced. So that if I saw serious performance problems, I didn't want to just hand wave it away and go like, we're on a fast enough machine. I wanted to see like, oh wait, this thing is taking 30% of the time doing it. Can I whittle that down? I wanted to be able to see in a coarse grain like what was going on. And if I could get it so that it was running at a really good speed on a Raspberry Pi, it's going to fly on a real box.
Yeah, of course. What other filters do work from Lua at that point, rather not server-side included, but other things? What other things have you done? Like, have you done
there are other ones
proxy
that they,
or something?
That they have listed that it works with. Here, let me...
But is it just the internal flag or not? Like, can you switch off the internal flag and have it work?
I switch off the internal flag so I could see it looking. And if I call the URL directly, works fine.
The server-side include URL that – like if you call the URL that
if
Lua
I call the
is actually
If I call the template URL, yeah, it works fine.
But Lua doesn't instigate the server-side include. Wait. What does Lua get? The file before the server-side includes?
According to the documentation, it's calling exactly what an HTTP call would be, except that it's not actually going in HTTP socket. It's calling an internal API.
Okay. But what I'm asking you is – have you just had Lua grab that URL and print it and respond, echo it back to show you what it actually is? Is it getting the template or is it getting – oh, the URL is actually the template plus the other things. So is it getting – what is it getting? Is it getting a 404 or something?
No, it's getting back the template, just not running the server-side include transform step.
Okay, so it's getting the template back without the server-side
right.
include step. Okay.
Or rather with the server-side includes unprocessed.
So it sounds like – yeah, so are you going to file the bug or are you just going to fix it? Is Nginx open source?
It is, and the thing is, I don't know if it's an Nginx bug or a Lua Nginx module bug, and there's a part of me that's just like, you know what, why don't I just implement this where Lua is doing the substitution, it's called gsub, and just be done with it, but...
Okay, to add to this, it looks like your Raspberry Pi is offline, because we can't roll dice on the bot anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Especially
Miles.
When you spell it correctly.
You bought one down. Oh, that's right. We had a power outage. I didn't start it back up again.
You don't have a backup power supply for your Raspberry Pi?
No, I don't. It's not on a UPS.
It's like a 9-volt battery.
It can run forever.
A UPS. Oh, no, the power's out. It doesn't come back on for 27 days. The Raspberry Pi might go out.
But see, that's actually another good reason to have a Raspberry Pi is you could have a server running that where the UPS that is normally supposed to handle a whole machine handles your home router, your cable modem, and your Raspberry Pi, and it will stay up effectively, you know, for that entire
Miles, until the tree takes the telephone lines out.
Miles, what about changing the pattern where when you edit content on the site, it spits out a file that is the Lua rendered file to the file system, and then that with server-side includes serves the image, or serves the file.
Sorry?
Just generate the HTML. Yeah.
Yeah. So create it like a hard cache instead.
Oh, have a step where I'm saying, here's process all my templates and make my templates available.
Yeah, I guess that's what you're... No.
Gee,
doesn't... Not the templates, no. The actual every page on
Oh, generate the site,
with server-side includes. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, not so much. It would work fine for us, but it wouldn't work a more dynamic site.
Yeah.
Total over-engineering. I love it. Is there such a thing
Actually, you just... Something just came to mind that might actually...
Bye.
Goodbye.